This is the lecture tape from May 5th, 1999. We're at the Battle of Ai, which is Joshua chapter 7 and 8. What an exciting time this was for Israel. The first conquest had been made, and just as God promised, they took the city in a total victory. God was good. God was to be praised. Israel was on an emotional high. The capture of Jericho had given Israel a foothold now into central Canaan. The next strategic step would be the capture of the city of Ai, which was about 15 miles northwest. With the capture then of Jericho and Ai, that would secure their entrance then into western Canaan. Now, when we left off last week with chapter 6, we read, "The Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land." And chapter 7 begins, "But." You see, the author gives us a little bit of insight into what is going to happen. Israel had just had a wonderful success, but now they're about to experience defeat. And the reason given is 7:1 is, "But the Israelites acted unfaithfully." This word unfaithful in Hebrew is ma'al, and it's used exclusively for infidelity, either to God or to a marriage. Israel had been unfaithful to God through disobedience. God had been very specific before they even went into battle, saying, "Don't take any of the things that are devoted to me, because if you do, you'll bring destruction upon yourself and trouble on Israel." Well, with this information then, our narration jumps back to what's happening in camp. So we really should go from "The Lord was with Joshua and his fame spread throughout the land" to Joshua's preparation now of the Battle of Ai. He sends spies into Ai, just as he had done with Jericho. And the spies come back and say, "You know, this is really just a little tiny area. There's not many men in there. It's not well fortified. So we really only need to send a couple, 3,000 men in there. There's no reason to get the whole army involved in this, because it's just going to be a small matter to go in and take control over that." So soon, we see human judgment coming into this. We see no mention of God's words. We don't see any divine promises. We don't see any divine strategy. We just see the spies giving their assessment of the situation and Joshua then following up on what they suggest. He sends only 3,000 men. Well, we see that it's a resounding defeat. The men go up, and as soon as Ai realizes Israel's coming against them, their warriors come out. They begin killing the Israelites. The Israelites, realizing what happens, turn around and flee back down the way that they came. And we're told that the men of Ai chased them all the way to the stone quarries, which is about 3.5 miles from Ai. And in the process, 36 warriors of Israel lost their lives. Well, I thought about Joshua. He's back at camp, and he's probably anticipating, "Oh, it won't take too long, and the warriors will come back, and then we'll move forward." And as he sees them coming in the distance, he realizes something's wrong. Something's terribly wrong. When they meet up with Joshua, they say, "We were defeated, and 36 of our men are dead." Joshua apparently has no clue what happened. He immediately goes before the Lord, as Moses would have done, and we find him tearing his clothes and laying face down before the Ark of the Covenant, as well as all the elders of Israel also doing the same thing, only we read that they add ashes to their heads. What this is doing is this is going before the Lord in repentance, submission, and deep mourning. Had God abandoned them? He must have. Why? Joshua pours out his heart to God. Look at verse 7. "Sovereign Lord," this is Adonai Yahweh. Adonai means Lord and Master of the universe, Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. "Why did you ever bring this people across the Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan. Oh Lord, oh Adonai, what can I say now that Israel has been routed by its enemies? The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this, and they will surround us and wipe out our name from the earth. What then will you do for your own great name?" Joshua is absolutely heartsick over the loss. He begins to question his own commission. "God, did you really tell us to come over the Jordan, or were we supposed to stay on the other side with the Transjordan tribes? I don't understand, God." Now, I want you to notice something here. He's talking to God, but he is not doing like we've seen during the days of Moses, where they're grumbling and complaining, saying, "Why did you ever take us out of Egypt? It was much better back there. We had all this wonderful stuff. Never mind the fact that we were slaves. You know, we had onions and leeks and all this." They were grumbling and complaining. Joshua is not grumbling. He is searching with his whole heart to find meaning in this. God had forsaken them. He had abandoned them. And if God's not with them, then the Canaanites will soon figure this out, and they're going to gain confidence and come against Israel and totally destroy them. And then God's name is going to be disgraced. It says, Joshua lay before the ark until evening. Now, when we first read that, we think, oh, he's been there all day long, but I want to put this in perspective. In the morning, the warriors got up. They went 15 miles to Ai. They engaged in battle, and they returned. So they walked and traveled at least 30 miles, plus did a battle in between there. So I think Joshua didn't even get word until probably at least early afternoon. So apparently Joshua was there, though, for a good bit of time, and I wondered why God let him lay there prostrate before the ark. And I thought maybe God wanted Joshua to think this through, because God had been very clear. This should not have been a surprise to Joshua. And I wonder if maybe Joshua started going through in his mind all the instructions God had given to him. If he did, he would get to the battle of Jericho, and he would say that everything in the town belonged to God. It was to be devoted wholly to the Lord. And if anybody took anything, that he would be destroyed and they would bring trouble upon Israel. Whether or not he ever got to that point or not, we find that God says to Joshua, "Stand up. Get up, Joshua. That's enough." God didn't abandon Israel. Israel abandoned God. Someone has stolen what belonged to God and then lied about it and hidden the evidence. Look at verse 12. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run because they have been made liable to destruction. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction. God demands action now. He says, Joshua, here's the problem. Now, I want you to go ahead and consecrate all the people. Prepare them, have them bathe, cleanse themselves, and prepare their hearts, because tomorrow they're all going to stand before me, and I will show you the one who has committed the crime or has broken the covenant. God says that they were to come by tribes, clans, family, and eventually man, until he points out which one. God had already made it very clear what that penalty was going to be. And so the people begin their consecration process that night. I wonder if anybody slept knowing that somebody had sinned in the camp and knowing what would happen on the next day. I don't know. We're told early the next morning the procession before the Lord begins. And I can almost picture it in my mind. They were to come first by tribes. And so you wouldn't march all 2 million people, but you would march the representative or the elder of each one of the tribes. And they would come stand before the ark of the Lord, and the high priest would cast the Urim and Thummim, which is the casting of the lots, and find God's decision. So they would come in order. First would come Reuben, and the high priest would cast those and say, no, it's not the tribe of Reuben. Then would come Simeon, and again the casting, no, it's not Simeon. Levi, no, it's not Levi. The fourth son comes, Judah. Casting of the lots, yes, it's the tribe of Judah. Judah has received two blessings. Judah has been the most honorable and considered the royal tribe. And according to Jewish history, when the tribe of Judah was taken, the valiant warriors of Judah immediately pulled out their swords and stood there and vowed before the Lord that they would not put those swords away until the criminal had been punished and the name of Judah had been cleared. Well, once the tribe of Judah was chosen, they came then by clans and family and man by man until Achan is chosen. Now, Joshua doesn't have to act as judge to Achan because God's already done so. And so as Achan comes and stands before Joshua, Joshua speaks to him in fatherly love. He says, son, I want you to confess all. I want you to give praise to God because he has revealed this sin. By confessing it out loud to Joshua, what Achan is doing is confessing it to the Lord, making a full renunciation of what he has done, and also acknowledging that God is just and right, and that God has chosen correctly, that he is the one that committed the sin, and that God's punishment is indeed just. In verse 20, Achan replied, "It is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonian, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of silver weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and I took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." Do you see the progression of the sin? He says, "I saw, I coveted, and so I took." The sin in this case began in his eyes. Achan went in and saw this beautiful robe. Many believe it belonged to the king and was probably worn during matters of state. It was just incredibly exquisite. It also would have contained, if this indeed was the robe it was, would have contained gold and silver threads throughout it. Well, once he saw it and coveted and took it, it made it very easy then to simply take a little silver, a little gold. And what he took actually was not a large or heavy amount, so it could have easily been hidden all within the robe. He takes it home into his tent, digs a hole, and places it in the ground. Well, verse 22 says Joshua sent messengers, and they go to the tent, and there it was, hidden just exactly as he had said, with the silver underneath it. They took the things from the tent, brought them to Joshua and all the Israelites, and spread them out before the Lord. This act of spreading these things out before the Lord is an act of returning to God what belonged to him rightfully. They're saying, "Israel is not withholding anything that belongs to you." If you think back to the law, you'll remember that the death penalty could not be carried out unless there was two or more witnesses. And I want to show you right here that we have three witnesses. God convicted Achan by the casting of the lots. Achan convicted himself by confessing. Joshua finally convicted him by producing the evidence of the stolen goods, which were indeed found in his possession. The resulting sentence was exactly as God had given it before the event even happened. The sin not only required Achan's life, but also demanded his name. By taking what was devoted to the Lord, Achan placed himself in the category of that which was devoted to the Lord by fire. It also required any future reference to him, his name, any future generations. So we find that not only Achan, but his entire family and everything that belonged to him was given back to the Lord. The memory of Achan was given to the Lord forever. It seems very, very harsh to us, and yet that's the way God had said it would be. Many believe that because the tent living was so confined that everybody in the family would have been aware of what Achan had done, and by not saying anything had actually given consent to his sin. We find that even though they were to be destroyed by fire, they are first stoned to death. That is far more humane than being burned. After their death, they are piled together with all of their belongings, set on fire, and then a pile of stones is placed over them as a memorial to the Lord and as a reminder to all who pass of the sin of Achan. Joshua then names the place the Valley of Achor, which is the Valley of Trouble. Well, as soon as the sin was dealt with, God's fierce anger, which was his readiness to destroy the people because they had broken the covenant, now turns away and his favor returns. If you remember, it said that when the people realized that they had lost the battle and lost 36, their hearts melted in fear. We find God's reassurance coming to them in 8:1. It says, "Then the Lord said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged.'" God's assurance is that they will now have a victory, and once again, he will be with them. And then he lays out the plan of attack. He says, "Take the whole army with you. Go up and attack Ai, for I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its kings as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock for yourself. Set an ambush behind the city." God said all the warriors were to participate, and that included Joshua. Now, the city was very small. They probably didn't need very many warriors, but this is a holy war. This is God's war, and as such, all of Israel must participate. We talked about Jericho last week and the fact that it was the first fruits. It was the very first city that God gave Israel in the Promised Land. Now he is ready to bring in the harvest, if you will. And so he says, now Israel can have the plunder of Ai. If Achan had only waited one city, he would have gotten the wealth that he wanted. And yet he took what belonged to the Lord and was his first. Well, under the direction of the Lord, we find that Ai is to be taken by ambush. And we read that Joshua chooses 30,000 of the best men and sends them out at night to hide behind the city. Now, most of the commentaries believe that the English translation of this is not quite correct. They believe it would be better interpreted that he sent the commanders of the 30,000 most valiant warriors over. That would be 30 commanders, each one commanding 1,000. 30,000 men hiding around a city this small would be very difficult not to be seen. 30 men would be more likely, and yet God's certainly in the business of doing miracles. So there may have been 30,000, there may have been 30. It makes no difference. We find these men going ahead at night and hiding. This is very non-traditional warfare because, remember, there are no lights. They aren't going to go with torches or lamps because that would indicate that somebody was coming. And in pitch darkness, anytime there's light, it would alert someone. But we find them going at night. And, of course, we also know there's lions and there's other animals prowling around at night. So this was more dangerous, and they do hide. Well, at sunrise, Joshua advances with the rest of the men. As I said, it's a 13 to 15 mile trek from Jericho to Ai, but it's also a 3,200 foot climb up the mountain from Jericho to Ai. What does Joshua do? He camps right in plain view of Ai. There's a valley just below Ai, and that's where he sends up his troops. Evening comes, they settle in for the evening. His next move is very strange. It would appear that he sets up a second ambush because he sends out 5,000 men. And it appears that Bethel is about 2 miles away from Ai. And he knows that when Ai is engaged in battle, Bethel will come to the aid of their neighbor. And so he sets a second ambush up to stop those men from helping Ai. And with this second ambush, they actually kill all the warriors of Bethel at the same time as Ai, even before they get to the bulk of the battle going on. Well, everyone's ready. The sun comes up in the morning. And what happens? Look at verse 14. The king of Ai saw Israel, and then he and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet them in battle at a certain place that overlooks the Aruba. But he did not know that an ambush had been set against him behind the city. Joshua and all Israel let themselves be driven back before them, and they fled toward the desert. All the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai or Bethel who did not go after Israel. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel. Did you see what happened? The king saw, and he hurried out. I bet he could hardly wait. He thought, these stupid Israelites, we already bet him once doing this. Now they've come to do it again. Let's just take care of this very, very quickly. And we see that they didn't leave any warriors left in Ai, and they left the city open, totally vulnerable. We read in Jericho that it was shut up tight. Now Ai, a much smaller city, had become overconfident, and it was left totally vulnerable. Look at verse 18. Then the Lord said to Joshua, hold out towards Ai the javelin that is in your hand, for unto your hand I will deliver the city. So Joshua held out his javelin towards Ai. I want you to see this. Joshua's javelin, or his sword, becomes the sword of the Lord. Moses' shepherd's staff, or rod, became the rod of the Lord. Moses was a shepherd to the people. He led them lovingly, giving them direction, guidance, instruction. Joshua is the general. He's the commander of their army, and he's leading them forward in God's battle. His symbol of the Lord becomes his javelin. And whenever he holds that up, he says, God is the one who will give us the victory, and God is the one to be praised. It's also very practical because I'm told during this Bronze Age that we're in right now, the javelin would have reflected the sun and he could easily use it to signal the men who are in ambush. With His holding of the javelin out, the ambush does come out, goes into the city, destroys all who are living there, and sets it on fire. As the smoke begins to rise, the men of Ai look back and see their city in flames and realize what's happened. They turn to return. They turn around to go back to Ai, and as they do, they realize they're surrounded now. And we read in verse 25, 12,000 men and women fell that day, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not draw back the hand that held out his javelin until he had destroyed all who lived in Ai. The battle was a complete victory, just as God had said. There's also a little footnote there. We're told that the king of Ai was taken alive to Joshua and then hung on a tree until evening. We're told in Jewish history that the king of Ai was considered a wicked and vile man. He was a notorious blasphemer of the God of Israel. And so Joshua executes him with the sword of the Lord, and then he is impaled dead on a pole at the city gates and hung there until evening. This was very traditional ancient warfare. And then as the sun went down, Joshua took him down off of that pole, buried him in a pile of rocks at the city gate, and that also was part of the ancient warfare where the person would be buried by their enemy. The pile of stones then becomes a memorial again to the Lord God of Israel. Well, in the middle of all of these wars, we come to verse 30 and are totally surprised that Joshua chose this moment in time now to have a religious ceremony. Battles are raging around them, and Joshua decides, oh, now it's time to go and carry out the instructions of Moses, to go to Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal and renew the covenant of the Lord. They have to travel to the place God designates, which is near Shechem. That is 20 miles north into enemy territory. In your handout today, I've given you a map. And I want you to see how far they had to travel. And it wasn't just the warriors. It included women and children as well. We have some interesting information because Shechem we're very familiar with. In the book of Genesis, that was a very special place to Abraham. And of course, we have the infamous battle that took place there with the family of Jacob, where Shechem came and raped his daughter Dinah. And this is where Simeon and Levi go in and kill all the Shechemites and, of course, are cursed from that point on. So Shechem is very important to the history of Israel. There are letters dating from 1380 BC that have been uncovered, and they are very interesting because they say that in Shechem, including the prince of Shechem, are relatives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They said that during the famine, when all of Jacob's family went to Egypt, that after the 7 years of famine, some of them returned and settled in Shechem. We automatically assume all of Jacob's family remained there for the 400 years, but apparently some of them left and settled into Shechem. And as such, they were very open to Israel's return to the land and had no difficulty with them coming into the territory there because they actually passed within a half a mile of Shechem. We're also told in Wycliffe commentary that Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim face each other, and they are a huge natural amphitheater. Even if you go today, there are big bays that are carved naturally in the base of each one of those. And by having six tribes standing at the base of each mountain, as they speak to one another, their voices are amplified and they would be able to be heard very clearly. Well, Moses' instructions had been given in Deuteronomy 27. I send you back there today in your lesson. And we find that Joshua carries out Moses' instructions exactly. First come the sacrifices, both the burnt offering and the fellowship offering, followed by the carving of the Ten Commandments in the stones covered with plaster. And then Joshua read the law to the whole nation. 8:33 I found very interesting. It says, all Israel, aliens and citizens alike, stood there beside the Ark of the Covenant and listened to the reading of the law. Did you see that? All Israel, the aliens and citizens alike. Who were the aliens? This was Rahab and her family. I thought, how soon after the Battle of Jericho, where Rahab and her family became part of Israel, they were involved in the covenant ceremony. They stood on Mount Gerizim as part of the tribe of Judah now, saying Amen as the blessings were read. How beautiful it was that God just incorporated them so quickly into the family of Israel. Well, the hard part of this lesson for me was that only one in approximately 600,000 warriors had acted unfaithfully to God, yet he considered all of Israel unfaithful. One of their group had sinned in secret and yet not been separated from the rest of the people, so all of them were being held accountable. I guess part of the lesson is that no one can sin in total isolation. I thought it's a little like a flu germ. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it won't go out and infect others. Sin does affect the whole community. This lesson, along with Sunday's servant, just really hit home to me. In our lesson, Israel's just received all of God's blessing. They've just taken their first city. They were in the process of receiving God's blessings, but selfishness arose. And the sin of Achan progressed from I sought to I coveted to I took what belonged to God and what he was not to have. Joshua's reaction, not knowing of the sin but seeing God's hand withdrawn, was concerned first off for his people. But there was more than that. He was concerned because he was jealous for the name of God. In verse 8 it said, "What will I say to the people? The Canaanites are going to realize this, and they're going to come and destroy Israel. What will happen to the honor of your name, God?" We've come to understand in both our study as well as Eastern culture the importance of a name. It goes far beyond the importance of the human's reputation to the very future of the name holder. Joshua is saying, if Israel is wiped out by her enemies, who will carry on your name? Lord, how will the world know that you alone are the true God if Israel's wiped out? Achan's sin was not just wanting something that wasn't to be his. It was not fearing, not giving honor or reverence to the Lord. He had no regard for the name of the Lord. He was willing to risk all for his own personal gain. God had clearly stated the consequences of disobedience. He says, if you take the things that were devoted to me, then you will be destroyed, and furthermore, you will bring trouble upon the whole nation of Israel. And Achan did bring his own destruction and that of his family, and he did bring trouble on all Israel. Only when Joshua removed the sin from camp did God's anger turn away and he restore his protection and blessings. I couldn't help but think about America. We've been asking ourselves over and over in these last few weeks, how could our youth of America become so evil and so violent? How could these mass murders occur in our schools? And yet God's word is very clear about what happens when we no longer fear God. Are we, like Joshua, jealous for God's name? Do we care what happens to God's reputation? You know, when I was very young, everybody seemed to be a Christian. Everybody talked about God. Everybody praised God. We prayed in school. We had religious education. We sang hymns. And then we got to the 60s when they started mocking God. And then we got to the 70s where I remember so clearly seeing the front page of the paper, hearing the news, seeing Time and Newsweek magazine with the headlines, God is dead. You see, to America, I think God died in the 70s. Because now, they don't mock God. They just ignore him as if he doesn't even exist. All the way through the book of Moses, we're told that parents are to teach their children God's laws and God's ways. He told Joshua, do not let this book of the law depart out of your mouth, but meditate on it day and night, being careful to obey all that's in it. Then you will be prosperous. Then you will have success. God's command has not changed for his children. We are to know and to obey his laws. And as parents, grandparents, friends, we are to teach our children. God tells us in 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sins and heal their land. Let's get jealous for God's name.